In this part of Focus, we return to a topic that we certainly have discussed before on this show, and that is the place of religion in American public life and in essentially the founding and the identity of this country. And here's a question for you. You can decide where you'd like to place yourself in this debate. Did the framers of the U.S. Constitution believe that America was and always would be a Christian nation? Or were they secularists who had a very strong belief in the idea of separation of church and state? Well, our guest with this part of Focus 580, John DiIulio, says, in fact, both of those things might be myths, and that the truth perhaps lies somewhere in between. He is a professor of politics, religion, and civil society at the University of Pennsylvania. He was the first person to be appointed to head the White House Office of Faith and Community-Based Initiatives. And he is the author of a recently published book that we'll be talking about. The title of the book is Godly Republic, A Centrist Blueprint for America's Faith-Based Future. That is the subtitle. It's published by the University of California Press and is out now in the bookstores and does indeed try to chart something of a mid-course in between the two endpoints of the conversation we have in this country on this subject. Questions certainly are welcome if people would like to join us. All we ask is that callers are brief in their comments, if as brief as they can be, just so that we can keep things moving along and get as many different people in as possible. But certainly, questions and comments from listeners are welcome. We'd like to get you into the conversation. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that one is good anywhere that you can hear us. That is 800-222-9455. So if you're listening on the air, on the radio around Illinois and Indiana, or if you're listening on the internet anywhere in the country, you may use that toll-free line. Again, here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. And toll-free, 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers. Professor DiIulio, hello.
Yes, hi, how are you?
I'm fine, thanks, and thanks for talking with us. We appreciate it. It seems to me that among people who do want to debate the subject, it can be pretty fierce from the people who take essentially the two positions there that I lined out at the beginning, whether either that the framers were Christians and intended the United States to be a Christian country, or they were largely secularists who, whatever their personal beliefs were, believed very strongly in this idea of church and state. I guess I'm wondering whether you have some sense of where the most people who haven't actually voiced an opinion, who have not been involved directly in this debate, who've just watched it go on between the people who want to take those two sides, where do you think most people are on this question?
Well, you know, it's interesting. If you ask, if you look at the polling data, which is our, you know, of course, our best source for knowing what mass public thinks on most issues, look at polls by the Pew Trusts or polls by Gallup or other credible organizations, people will say in response, you know, is America a Christian nation? You'll get majorities generally that will say that. But then when you ask the next question, you know, well, does that mean that the government was intended to give Christians or Christians of a particular denomination a privileged position in our republic? The answer, vast majority, no. And I think if you combine those two polling results, the mass public has it pretty close to the historical truth.
That being from your reading, that is that people, particularly those people who were involved in founding the country, had personal faith, had strong beliefs, and thought that that was important, and yet at the same time there was this very strong commitment, if not to religious pluralism, at least to the idea that they didn't want the government telling people what they should believe.
Right. I mean, it's interesting because what has happened really over the latter part of the 20th century, what happened is that scholars who recognized that the founding fathers did not want to create and did not create any constitutional so-called Christian nation. I mean, they wrote explicitly into the body of the Constitution, even before the First Amendment, you know, prohibiting establishment of religion. They wrote into the body of the Constitution an explicit provision saying there shall be no religious tests for office holding. Now, you don't do that kind of thing if you're out to establish any particular kind of a religious regime. But the folks who emphasized that, in the scholars mainly, in the latter part of the 20th century, also took the position that, well, then they must not have been very serious Christians themselves. And alas, the vast majority of them were. I mean, there were exceptions, Thomas Jefferson to a degree, certainly Benjamin Franklin, and most certainly if you're willing to include folks like Thomas Paine. But the vast majority, including the chief architect of the Constitution, James Madison, who was tutored at Princeton, which then was a new light Scott Presbyterian institution by the Reverend John Witherspoon, who was a man who signed both the Declaration and the Constitution, were serious. They were serious, committed Christians, certainly by contemporary standards we consider them as such, and yet they were absolutely adamant that no group should have a preferred or privileged position in the new republic.
In on the very first page of the first chapter, where you set out these questions, where you essentially pose these two possibilities, and then go on to say that in fact you feel that it was not really either of those things, you say that, you write, the framers of the Constitution founded a new government they hoped would guide America's rise not as either a secular state or a Christian nation, but as a godly republic marked by religious pluralism, and the godly there is with a small g, not with a big G.
Right.
What does that mean? What is a godly republic?
Well, what it means is that a lot of the debates that get the most attention, or at least draw the most heat, if not certainly not the most intellectual or civic light, are debates about things like, well, should you have In God We Trust, on the money, or should the court, Supreme Court, open, with God Save This Court, or should there be chaplains on the public payroll? The framers of the Constitution, and certainly the Supreme Court since the mid-20th century, and most definitively since the mid-70s, early 80s, has been very clear in saying all of that is just fine. It's the 1952 decision, probably the single most interesting line in late or mid-20th century jurisprudence, was written by one of the most liberal, you might even say secular liberal, justices, William O. Douglas, who stated that, our political institutions presuppose a supreme being. And Justice Douglas did not go on in that decision in 1952 to say, and that therefore government should be able to fund religion, et cetera, et cetera. He was actually ruling the opposite. But what he was stating or rearticulating was the animating understanding of the framers, which we had begun to lose at that point, which is that it's okay to have expressions of religion in the public square, so long as that does not result in any group having a privileged or preferred position, and so long as public offices, the full rights of citizenship, etc., are open to Methodists, Muslims, Mormons, Quakers, Catholics, Jews, and people of no religious faith at all.
Mm-hmm. And I suppose as some people would say, that the problem we have is, wow, that's a fine principle. In reality, that it just doesn't work that way. We like to give lip service to the idea of religious pluralism, but that we don't, we're not very good actually putting that into practice.
Well, I think there's certainly some truth to it. I mean, you can certainly point historically. I happen to be a Roman Catholic, and certainly so much of the history of so-called church state separation, and so many of the laws passed in the late 19th century were expressly and politically driven, motivated to discriminate against Catholics, to keep Catholics essentially from obtaining positions of political power or social status. I mean, that was the explicit purpose of the so-called Blaine Amendments favored by the Republican presidential candidate and former Maine Governor James G. Blaine. And so there is a tradition of that. On the other hand, however, if you look at most of American history, certainly since the middle part of the 20th century down to the present, you find the Supreme Court struggling to be fair-handed and apply a so-called neutrality doctrine test in cases of religion's place in the public square. You find most political leaders in both parties being pretty much even-handed, non-discriminatory, and welcoming of people of all faiths and of no faith. And you also find, as I said earlier, most Americans feeling very much that people should not be discriminated against on the basis of religion, certainly not discriminated against with respect to any matters of public law or policy.
Mm-hmm. Nowadays, I think that we're used to hearing a lot of politicians, leaders, people who occupy political office or running for political office, talk about their religious faith. And certainly we have heard a lot of that already here now that we're in the presidential primary season, and I'm sure we'll be hearing more. Going back to, again, thinking though to what we know of those men, and they certainly were men who were the political leaders in the early years of America, acknowledging the fact that many of them were personal men of faith and had to have taken their faith with them, so to speak, into the public square, and that it was there. It had something to do with what it is that they believed and what it is they said and what it is they did. And yet, at the same time, it doesn't seem to have been addressed in such an open, obvious sort of a way. You know, for example, and this is maybe an unfair example, but I think of some recent comments by Mike Huckabee that the reason that he won the Iowa caucuses was that it was God's will. Somehow I can't quite imagine George Washington standing up and saying, right, I believe that I'm president of the United States today because that was what God wanted.
And I think that's a fair point, and that's really exactly the point vis-a-vis especially our contemporary public and political leaders. The tradition that we had, interestingly enough, what the example of the framers shows, at least on this relatively narrow point, is that you can be a committed person of faith, whether Anglo-Protestant tradition or some other religious tradition. You can be a deep and true and even an orthodox believer, and yet you can also follow the rules of the regime, the rules of the republic, the rules of even-handedness and non-discrimination and an openness to people of all faiths and of no faith. The founding fathers, by and large, there were exceptions, and most of the exceptions, by the way, were among the anti-federalists, the people who opposed the Constitution's ratification, and did so, as I unearth a bit in the book, for reasons that we've sort of forgotten about. In addition to their other concerns about the Constitution, they were concerned that, alas, this godly republic would not preference or privilege people of Anglo-Protestant tradition. And they were quite right. It did not, and it was not so intended. Now, today, it's interesting. You cite the Huckabee example, but take a look at Barack Obama. Take a look at his book, for example, The Audacity of Hope. The book is punctuated with references to the senator's religious faith, his religious beliefs. He talks about how he begins many of his days in the Senate in a prayer group, which is, by the way, a bipartisan prayer group. I think it's possible, in other words, for people in the public square who are people of serious faith to negotiate, to navigate to a destination of religious pluralism in what they say as well as in what they do.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm glad you raised the issue of Senator Obama, because I did not mean to be partisan myself, and because I think that it is very true that many, many candidates, Republicans and Democrats, talk about their religious faith,
yeah,
that they feel that that's
sure.
And one can only listen to them and judge to what extent that has to do with a deep commitment and to what extent that is a strategic kind of a choice. I don't know.
Well,
but it's not just a Republican thing.
No, not at all. In fact, the interesting thing is that this time around, 2008, there's no, by any measure, the Democrats as a whole in the race have a higher, if you will, religion content or quotient than the Republicans in the race do. And that would extend, even if you did a sort of a boring academic exercise, is what guys like me in the end get paid to do, which is to look at, you know, to content analyze their speeches, not just for the presidential election season, but going back. And you will find there that Senator Clinton, you will find there that even Senator Edwards, who isn't quite as explicit about it on the campaign trail as he had been earlier in his career, certainly Senator Obama, and also several of the Republicans. And of course we have the interesting tangle or example of Mitt Romney and the issue that has become the issue of his Mormonism. But most of these candidates are pretty much serious people of faith, but who also buy into, if you will, the constitutional predicate of having this be a pluralistic republic with respect to religion.
How, though, then, and when we get down to some of these bedrock issues, things like should public money go to some sort of religious cause, either in the case, for example, of White House office that you were involved in, or religious schools, or the matter of prayer in public school, or the matter of should a clergyman give a kind of an invocation, should there be a prayer before the opening of Congress, or should there be a, is it okay for you to put up a cross in front of City Hall, you know, those sorts of things. I mean, when it really gets down to these kinds of bedrock questions, it still seems that there's still a couple of important issues here.
Sure.
You know, what people believe and what they practice in their homes and in their places of worship is one thing, but City Hall and the public schools is something else.
Right. Yeah, you're right. And of course, you might say both God and the devil are in the details, right, when you get down to particular cases and cases and controversies. But, for example, with respect to public funding for religious nonprofits, there the Supreme Court, and I hear I'm pretty much singing from a hymnal that not many others sing from, but I actually happen to be of the view that the Supreme Court has done a fairly good job, warts and all, of trying to have a jurisprudence that respects these general principles of religious pluralism and applies them fairly even-handedly. And that is why the Supreme Court has plainly laid down where the double yellow lines are between which we must stay in our church-state relations with respect to public funding. And one is that funding can never be used to proselytize, to promote a particular religious worldview. Secondly, that any public funding that goes to religious nonprofits, whether churches, synagogues, mosques, or community-serving religious organizations, that whether soup kitchens or clothes centers or food banks or welfare-to-work programs, that money has to be first and foremost and only for a civic or secular purpose. And that third, finally, and most ambiguously, of course, that it involve no long-term excessive entanglement, quote-unquote, between the church and state, between government and religious nonprofits. Now, in the actual cases and controversies that have come before the court, I would say over the past 25 years, the court has pretty much applied this so-called neutrality doctrine along those three principles I just articulated. Most of the American people support those three principles and are willing to have, you know, obviously groups like Catholic Charities, Salvation Army, Lutheran Social Services, and others have been working and partnering with government to deliver social services for many, many, many decades. The real issue, so far as I was concerned and remain concerned, is applying those same standards when it comes to smaller community-based and minority community-serving religious nonprofits. And there, too, you have a consensus. Where things get heated and hot is really at the margins, at the two extremes. Those who would like, for example, government money to go to organizations that proselytize or that hire only their own co-religionists, which is, in my view, unconstitutional. And at the other extreme, those who would like to pretty much eliminate or marginalize any expression of religion in the public square.
Just, I have some callers here, and I hope that these folks will understand. I'll get to them in just a moment. I do want to ask one further question, and that was a little bit about your experience. As I mentioned, you were the first director of the White House Office of Faith-Based and Community Initiatives, appointed by President Bush in 2001, I believe.
Right.
And you occupied that position for only about 7 or 8 months, and I you left, and I know the reason you left was not because you didn't believe in the whole idea of the office. That wasn't it. It was something else. What was it?
Well, the short answer is I had said that I would only stay 6 months, ended up staying 8. I'm not sure that if I had not made that pledge that I would have stayed in any case, because by the time I got through the 6 months, which is the period when we were to issue a report, which essentially was a pretty much of an academic exercise looking at the actual grant-making procedures across 5 cabinet agencies, by the time we got to that point, the politics of the issue, the politics of the extremes, what I call the orthodox secularists on the one side and the orthodox sectarians on the other, had pretty much come to dominate the public discourse, certainly in Washington at least, on the issue. Largely forgotten were the, you know, people in places like my own Philadelphia, in North Philadelphia, Dorchester, Boston, downtown Detroit, South Central LA, and other places where you have communities of religious leaders at the grassroots level who are struggling to expand services, to provide welfare-to-work services, after-school programs, lunch programs, job care, job training programs, and just looking for a little extra government support and willing to play by the existing extant constitutional rules. They were largely marginalized by people who wanted to fight over the more symbolic issues, wanted to fight over issues of proselytizing with public funds or having money go to groups that would only use that money to hire their own co-religionists. It sort of became a casualty of the culture wars, if you will. And that often happens, unfortunately, in our politics, domestic politics. I just I happen to have, in that case, a front row seat.
It's my understanding, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, is that when one looks at the various kind of religious organizations that have received money under the White House Office of Faith-Based Initiatives, that the vast majority of them have, in fact, been Christian. organizations?
Well, I think that if you look at it and sort of try to code them by religious affiliation, I think that's probably going to prove to be correct. In fact, I'm sure it's correct. Of course, that would be correct if you just did it at random, since the vast majority of religious organizations in the country at large, mm-hmm. and as well as the community serving organizations are Christian. The real question is whether, and this issue has been raised and discussed and debated, not much, I don't have any inside information or a definitive perspective on it either, as to whether, you know, there's political steering of this money to particular groups. I would tell you that, in such as I've been able to look at as I did background research for the book, I would say that the most interesting aspect of the pattern is that there's not much pattern at all. That is to say, the idea for the increasing the support and the funding was to target programs, and I'll give you very quickly an example, like the Big Brothers Big Sisters of America program that mobilizes mentors, in particular for children who have one or both parents incarcerated, the so-called AMACHI program. The idea, which Big Brothers Big Sisters, which of course is a 100-year-old marquee secular nonprofit organization, was to mobilize mentors from local churches and to platoon those mentors into the lives of these children to produce those great results that we all know from the research mentoring has. That program existed before the office was created. It was sort of an exemplar program, and the idea was to target funds, new funds, additional funds, and support, technical assistance, on programs that met those kinds of deep unmet social needs, working through public-private religious secular partnerships. Almost nobody has a problem with those programs. The problem, those kinds of programs. The problem is when people want to pick at the questions at the extremes, and they, of course, end up dominating the debate.
We are almost at a midpoint, and we'll get to callers here. I appreciate your being patient. Let me just introduce again our guest, John DiIulio. He is the Frederick Fox Leadership Professor of Politics, Religion, and Civil Society, and Professor of Political Science at the University of Pennsylvania, has written on a number of subjects, including this relationship between religion and public policy. His most recent book is titled Godly Republic, A Centrist Blueprint for America's Faith-Based Future, and it is published by the University of California Press. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana, toll-free 800-222-9455. First caller up is in Bloomington, Indiana. Line 4. Hello.
Hi. Would you comment on Chuck Colson's prison fellowship program? It's a faith-based. Yeah, you've probably heard of his program.
Sure. No, I know it very well.
Are you aware of a couple of things that I'd like you to comment on? One of them is they did some research, I believe it was at the University of Pennsylvania, on Chuck Colson, on the effect prison fellowship had on inmates, on jail inmates. They called it the Interchange Freedom Initiative. Interchange is not a highway junction.
It's right.
It's what happens inside a man's heart when he finds the Lord, and they were actually quite successful in reducing recidivism in our jails, and of course since they were successful, they got sued. And if memory serves, the first suit was brought in Iowa, wasn't it?
Yeah, in fact, the suit was brought in Iowa, and it gone all the way through the appeals process. Yes.
Yeah. You probably know more about that than I did. Would you
sure.
tell the story of that and your opinion of it?
I'm happy, Finn. Thank you for the question. Yeah, I mean, very briefly, and I probably know more about this than I should because in full disclosure, I was once upon a time, I think, the only Catholic member of the board of Prison Fellowship Ministries, which is a national evangelical ministry, as you pointed out, that was started by the former Watergate felon Chuck Colson, and who has devoted the entire rest of his life and really given virtually all of his money, I believe, to prison fellowship and its ministry to men behind bars, their families, to the children, youth, and families of prisoners. A really wonderful evangelical Christian organization that does that kind of work. The study you mentioned was done by a fellow who was then at the University of Pennsylvania, since gone on to Baylor University, and it did try to look at this prisoner reentry program that Prison Fellowship ran called Interchange Freedom Initiative, or, of course, everything has to have an acronym these days, IFI. And that program is operated in Texas and Iowa and some other places. And essentially, the study, mainly the statistical part of the study, repeated the findings of a Texas Department of Criminal Justice study, which showed that compared to, in the overall, there was no difference between inmates who participated in the program and otherwise comparable inmates who did not, in terms of their success of leaving prison and not recidivating or not committing new crimes. When they compared the graduates to all inmates, which is, you know, social scientists like myself sometimes will have a problem with that, and, you know, without getting into the technical details, but if you compare the graduates, yes, there you solve this difference. But the punchline of that study, the main part of that study really, and the part that didn't get much attention, was the ethnographic part, the description of how the program worked. That became much more consequential with respect to the lawsuit you mentioned, which came in Iowa, where essentially a federal district court said that the program was unconstitutional because it had too much of a sort of what I would call a faith-saturated content, and ordered Prison Fellowship to pay back, I think it was $1.5 million. On appeal, the court went to a 3-judge panel, which included, by the way, former Supreme Court Justice Sandra Day O'Connor coming out of retirement to do it, and that court reversed the federal district court's ruling, saying that, in fact, Prison Fellowship did not need to pay back that $1.5 million, but at the same time underlining some of the other aspects of the original court decision, saying that the program crossed the line in certain respects, governing church-state relations and having too much of a sort of a proselytizing content. So it was sort of a split decision, but on some of the key particulars, Prison Fellowship was upheld.
Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. We'll go to next someone here in Champaign. This is line one. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. If you take a careful reading of the Constitution, it says, the First Amendment says that Congress shall establish no law, shall pass no law establishing not this religion or that religion. It doesn't even say establishing a religion. It says Congress shall pass no law establishing religion, period. And it seems to me that things like putting one nation under God in the Pledge of Allegiance, which incidentally was written by a socialist, I love that, is totally contrary to that. The one other quick point I want to make,
mm-hmm,
is that you have to define what a Christian is. A Christian is one who believes in the Trinity. And if you look at the Founding Fathers, they were deists and Unitarians, and Unitarianism is not a Christian religion. They reject the Trinity. Thomas Jefferson made the statement that everybody eventually is going to be a Unitarian. John Adams was a Unitarian. Joseph Priestley was a Unitarian. And they were all, and also, one other final point on that is that in the poll taken in census taken in 1800, only 20% of the country claimed any kind of relationship to any religion at all. They were not a Christian nation. I'm sorry, but that's the truth. And I'll take my reply off the air.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Well, you raise a lot of interesting points. Let me just quickly, in the interest of time, try to go through the two or three key ones, I think. With regard to the religious belief sensibilities, if you will, of the Founding Fathers, it's true that some of them were so-called deists, and that some were Enlightenment-minded secularists and skeptics, and some, like my university's founder, Ben Franklin, impossible to categorize. He loved Philly taverns on Saturday nights more than churches on Sunday. We know that much, at least, about him. But the vast majority were, in fact, as I think all the historical scholarship shows at this point, and I don't think there's even much serious disagreement about it anymore, they were, in fact, committed religious believers, mostly in one or another Christian tradition. Not all Unitarians. You've got to remember, they're living after the crest of one of the Great Awakenings, and the Great Awakening was largely non-controversial. So you did have, and some of them, like Reverend Witherspoon, who I mentioned earlier, very orthodox in their particular religious beliefs as well. With respect to the first point you raised, which I think is really maybe the most important one, the Establishment Clause is there, but you got to remember that there's that other clause in that very same expression of the First Amendment, which is the also pass no law that restricts the free exercise of religion. And what we fail to remember sometimes is that those two clauses are both there. There's an Establishment Clause and a Free Exercise Clause, and they're in tension. And they were intended to be in tension. What do I mean? Just very quickly, you know, we don't tax religious property, right? Religious organizations under the IRS are automatically exempt from property taxes and don't even have to file a so-called Form 990. So churches uniquely, and churches here is the IRS term, by the way, for all houses of worship that the IRS uses. That's a bit of an anachronism, but there it is. Those organizations are uniquely privileged. Now, why is that? Because the power to tax is also the power to destroy, if not to deter. So you have a tension between not wanting to restrict the free exercise of religion on the one hand, but on the other hand, not wanting government to go so far as to establish a religion. Establishment initially meant taxing, you know, somebody to pay for somebody else's religious worship. We've never had much debate or dispute in this country about not having a religious establishment. What we're really talking about here is what scholars will refer to as indirect establishment. So there's a tension between indirect establishment and free exercise of religion rights, and that tension is just always going to be there because there are competing values at stake. Finally, with respect to the data, I would suggest taking a look at some of those Gallup surveys, Harris surveys, but most especially work that's been done recently by the Baylor Institute for Research on Religion, where they, you know, 40% plus of Americans, adult Americans now, identify themselves as born-again Christians. And I think Baylor found that barely 10, 11% of the public is not only 90% profess a belief in God, but only 10 or 11% are not affiliated with some kind of religious organization. So I think the numbers are pretty powerful, and they've been reported as well, by the way, in a lot of national news magazines. So if you're looking for good summaries, you'll find them there.
Mm. I guess I find myself going back to this idea that here the hang-up is the establishment clause. It's not so much the other thing, because we believe that people should have the right to practice their faith, have their faith, and carry it with them wherever they go, or not have faith. That's the more difficult thing seems to be this idea that government not do anything that seemed to favor a religion, or perhaps more importantly, favor religion over non-religion. And that if you were going to try to take the safest course on this, I suppose you would say, well, then that means that the government should be a very wide gap between anything that looks like religion and government.
Well, you know, and there are those who you know, have always taken some version of that view, and they have always been in the minority. It doesn't make them wrong, but they've been in the minority, certainly with respect to the constitutional law and jurisprudence. Even at the high watermark of so-called no aid or strict separation doctrine, the early to mid part of the 20th century, even then, that was very much the minority view. And the reason, again, is that you have to remember that essentially, so far as the Constitution is concerned, religion is marked handle with care. That is, it's singled out for special benefits, and it's singled out for special burdens. Okay, you can decide that you don't want to serve in the military as a conscientious objector for religious reasons, but not uniquely for religious reasons. You can have ethical, cultural, or non-religious reasons. Basically, the law as it has evolved is that with respect to establishment of religion, as long as you don't have an explicit government endorsement of a particular religion, you don't have to rid religion from the public square. And in fact, if we wanted to rid religion from the public square, we'd have an awful difficult time, since you'd have to start with the 42 state constitutions that make explicit reference to God.
Let's go on and talk with another caller here, line number two. This is also Champagne. Hello.
Let me ask a question. Was the Bush administration, I'm speaking of George W., is that administration the first to set up in the executive branch of the government, I guess particularly the White House, an office of faith-based initiatives?
It was the first to have by executive order an office by that name. It was not, however, the first by any means to have an office within the federal government and reporting to the White House. And the person who actually did this was President Clinton. President Clinton signed four so-called charitable choice laws that essentially were non-discrimination or anti-discrimination provisions of federal law governing the distribution of federal grants and contracts to religious nonprofits. The first actual center within the federal government was established within the Department of Housing and Urban Development under Secretary Andy Cuomo. So Bush essentially, the office essentially was, at least as the executive order and its mandate was written, it was essentially an office intended to carry out and implement the charitable choice laws that had been passed on a bipartisan basis and, you know, supported by President Clinton and Vice President Gore. Had it done that, I think it would have been largely non-controversial.
I thought I read something about you, and I even wrote a letter recently, I believe, in the New York Times about some religious establishment issue, but is it true that you left this office after a relatively short time because you thought the administration was applying the office in a manner where politics trumped policy?
Well, the truth is that I had announced, and once you announce it to the Washington Post, you've announced it forever. I had announced the day that I was appointed that I would stay for only 6 months because I had just actually moved from another university, and I have been involved in Washington virtually all my academic career, but I don't much like the town. It's not my kind of town. But I would have, I think, however, even had I not made that commitment and pledge and didn't have other things that I much preferred to do, I'm not sure I would have stayed in any case, in all honesty. And it is, there was a book published last year by a good friend of mine named David Kuo called Tempting Faith. It got a lot of attention. He became the deputy director of the office after I left, and at least in his view, the operation became highly politicized. Now, people can take issue and have taken issue with certain aspects of that argument. From what I write about in my book, I believe that the problem was really a failure to sustain the original vision, as I talked about earlier here today, vision of basically reaching out to community-serving grassroots groups that were doing good things to serve the especially poor in places like North Central Philly and South Central LA and other inner cities around the country. Had that vision been adhered to, or had that been the major work of the office, and had that been happening, I think I would have found it much more difficult to leave on schedule.
My most important question, David, and I promise you this is my last.
Sure.
Is I do believe the Supreme Court, with a majority opinion penned by Judge Alito last term, reached a decision concerning the constitutionality of the executive-based faith-based initiative program, and I'm confused by that as I'm confused about a number of cases where the Supreme Court tries to define the parameters.
You're in good company, sir. You're in good company because I studied this stuff and I'm confused.
Justice Alito, basically, and I'm not a constitutional scholar, but Justice Alito seemingly said this challenge was would not proper because the faith-based initiative program came out of the executive branch of government, and it would have had some validity if it had come out of the legislative branch.
That decision that you're referring to was brought by a group in Wisconsin, and it was essentially a challenge to the constitutionality of the office, but the specific challenge had to do with the conferences or training, so-called sessions, that the office, after I left, had taken up all across the country, and the claim was that these training conferences were really sort of political in character, and that in addition to that, the office itself was unconstitutional to begin with. What that decision ended up being about, and again, I'm not a lawyer myself, but I don't even play one on TV. How's that? But that decision, as I read it, was very much about the standing of the group that brought, that is, did the group that brought it have legal standing to file the suit? And the court's answer, in short, was no, it didn't have standing. So that it never really reached the substantive issues that were raised in the complaint.
All right. Thank you, sir.
All right. Thank you. Let me again very quickly introduce a guest, John DiOlio. He's a political scientist. He's a professor of politics, religion, and civil society and political science at University of Pennsylvania. He served as the first director of the White House Office of Faith-Based and Community Initiatives under President Bush from early 2001 until August of 2001, and is the author of a recent book that looks at faith in American life. His book is titled Godly Republic, A Centrist Blueprint for America's Faith-Based Future. It is published by the University of California Press. We'll go on to somebody else here, and I believe our next caller is in Effingham on our toll-free line, line 4, right here. Hello.
Yes. Can I make a statement?
Sure.
My studying of human activity and the humanoids first, which was the infancy of humanity. Neanderthals came, which got us the humanity to childhood. Homo sapiens have arrived, and our representative of lower adolescence, which is where we're stuck. And this program and other venues that make preachments about religion, human disrespect for each other, which, you know, is the only species I have ever read about that practices war. And now with political and religious things after the Reformation and then through the French Revolution, we are scratching at the middle adolescence in human affairs, but the progress forward and falls back. And it seems to me, with the sort of technology that humans possess now, we are on a road to destruction, both of ourselves, the environment, by any means necessary. And that is most disconcerting to myself. And as we see the progress, the no progress around the world in second, third, and fourth world countries, where power at any cost is all that matters. The same way here with the courts and the police and the things like the CIA and things we don't even know about that are driving everything to ruin. And would you comment on that? Can you?
Sure. You're above my pay grade, as they say, with respect to the breadth of your interests and concerns. But I can tell you that there have been a number of books. Let me answer this way: there have been a number of books recently by folks who are very concerned about religion's negative influence, not only in America but in world affairs and world history. People like Christopher Hitchens and Sam Harris have written what are now, I think, still books on the bestsellers list that take that point of view. And while I don't happen to agree with it per se myself, what I would say is that, going back to my interest or expertise in sort of looking at how others in the American political tradition have thought about this, the framers of the Constitution were interesting in that they were, alas, kind of religious believers, but who were very influenced, obviously, by Enlightenment ideas and ideals. You know, and for them, there was reason, but there was also faith. There was faith, but there was also reason. And if you really look at what they argued closely, what they seemed to believe was that religion was uniquely powerful. It was uniquely powerful as a force for bad and as well as a force for good. That is why they singled it out for special treatment first in the Constitution. That's why when James Madison talked about the kinds of things that would tear us apart or create so-called factions in our politics, the very first thing he mentions in Federalist Paper Number 10, written in defense of the Constitution, is a, quote, zeal for different opinions concerning religion, close quote. So, I mean, I guess they would say if you looked at, you mentioned the Third World and so forth, if you look at many parts of many parts of the less developed world or economically struggling world, you see that civil wars, sectarian violence, rooted in religion, is a big part of the story of why people have suffered so much and lost so many lives. But if you keep your focus on the very same places, you'll also find that much of the most important relief efforts, like the multi-billion-dollar anti-AIDS initiative in Africa and others, come out of the very same wellsprings of religiosity and religious worldview. So it is, I think, a human, all-too-human reality that the same wellsprings that produce beneficence also sometimes produce and have produced some of the most horrific excesses of humankind.
We just have about 5 minutes left. We now have a couple of callers. I want to try to get at least one more and come back here to Urbana for the next line one. Hello.
Hello. Yes, you seem to keep coming back to the premise that the Founding Fathers were Christians, in spite of the fact that the documentation shows that they were almost universally deists. And I think one has to consider what a deist considered God to be. They did believe in a religion, yes, but they considered God to be the grand mechanic who establish things, set things running, and then step back and let man run things and make a mess of it or not make a mess of it, but that God would not intervene. As such, the notion of divine guidance that our present president seems to have is antithetical to what they believed. And, in fact, their understanding of religion is such that they had a profound reason for believing that religion should be completely excluded from the government. And I think this has to be seen as their position. The fear that Madison had of religion being divisive is certainly was well-founded and certainly was from his experience. And as such, I can't see what premise you have for a religiously founded government.
Well, I appreciate that. No, well, again, I'm not saying that we have a, quote, religiously founded government, unquote, or that they all were Christians or Christians of a particular religious tradition or faith or all Anglo-Protestants of a particular faith. What I am saying is that this traditional notion, which was taught in sort of high school textbooks all the way, you know, up through and still taught now in many textbooks, that they were all deists or they were largely secularists or they were mainly Enlightened influences, belied by the last 35, 40 years of scholarship on the subject. And you could pick particular figures. Someone like James Madison lived a long time, wrote a lot of things, said a lot of things, certainly began his life and entered public life under direct influence of the Westminster Confessions and Reverend John Witherspoon, his mentor at what became Princeton University. As I said earlier, lived through the Great Awakenings. Their speeches, their public addresses, their private letters shot through with punctuated by references to religion, to God, to Almighty God, to the and so on. So the last 35, 40 years of scholarship, which hasn't quite made it, I think, into the popular, more popular sort of, or textbook, if you will, vernacular, I think shows that there was a lot more, if you will, religious content to their worldview. They read the Bible. Many of them, far more than they read John Locke. And if you read John Locke, he, alas, himself had a Christian sensibility. But the point is not that they were Christians or that they established a government favorable to Christians. Exactly the opposite is my view, that despite the fact that they were more influenced by religion in general and Christianity in particular, they nonetheless took a very strong position. And the reason they did in taking a strong position for religious neutrality was they believed what, alas, a truly non-religious individual, and this we could certainly agree, Voltaire, had written, which is essentially one religion you get tyranny, two religions you get civil war, but many religions, what Madison called a multiplicity of sects, ensures civil peace, or at least maximizes the possibility for civil peace and for the prospect that people will treat each other with the kind of mutual respect and regard that does not begin or end by asking, what's your faith or what's your religion, but are you a fellow citizen?
We're at the point here where we have about a minute or two. This is not an argument that's going to end anytime soon, particularly since, as you say, particularly as you say that people can go back and look at the writings of the founders, and not only can you find individuals conflicting with other individuals, you can even find within one person in their lifetime,
right.
they wrote
right.
different things. So that's kind of, you can kind of pick your quotes and play that if you want. Setting that aside, though, I guess what it comes down to is this question, well, what does that mean to us now? And I guess I still find myself thinking that the difficult question, it does indeed go back to that issue of activities of government, and does it appear in any sort of way that somehow government is favoring a particular religion or is favoring any religion?
Well, I would turn it around a bit and ask just very empirically, okay, because you say, you know, that's what scholars are for, revisionist scholarship. I mean, the writings of people like George Washington, there are now no fewer than 10 books. I've read 7 of them myself, published just the last 4 years on Washington's religious sensibility. So there's been a sort of a small explosion in research in this area. But let's put all that aside and just look as a sort of practical civic matter. What kind of society do we want to be? How do we need to recognize that apart from the question of is government somehow favoring religion or a particular religion, are people who are religious and provide social services in particular to people in need being disfavored or discriminated against is the other side of that question. In places around the country, we know that a third, for example, of all daycare provision is going on in the top 20 cities through one or another form of religious or faith-based nonprofit organization. We know that in some cities, as much as 40% of all the welfare-to-work services organizations are provided by religious nonprofits. Enormous amounts of social service delivery that we rely on every day and that we drive past, as it were, without a second thought, are in fact, whether they should or shouldn't be, for good or for ill, being provided by largely by grassroots religious groups. Again, put aside the the giant religious mega charities like Catholic Charities and Jewish Federations and Salvation Army and Lutheran Social Services, which, by the way, have always gotten and are now getting tens of billions of dollars all told from government to deliver social services. For me, the very narrow and important question, but important question is, what should be our disposition toward those community-serving religious organizations in places where we're trying to deliver social services to people in severe need, to disadvantaged children, youth, and families? That's the practical question that I hope that we'll all be able to focus on, independent of the wider and symbolic politics of the issue.
And you do just very, I can't give you much time to respond, but you do admit, I think, in the book, though, that there's no empirical evidence that shows that a religious-based organization does that any better than a secular organization.
Well, people have taken, I think, one piece of one chapter and said that, but the reality is, with all the evidence, and I'm talking here about Professor Robert Putnam at Harvard University, Professor Mary Jo Bain at Harvard University, and many, many other scholars, have shown is that volunteer mobilization happens more and better at the margin with these faith-based organizations. So in a world where we have so many unmet social needs and civic needs, and where we have indigenous, neighborhood-based religious organizations that are ready, willing, and able to provide these services, we have to ask the question whether we're going to be fair with them and also serve the needs of those who are indeed the neediest among us.
Our guest, John DiIulio, is political scientist. He's Frederick Fox Leadership Professor of Politics, Religion, and Civil Society and Professor of Political Science at University of Pennsylvania. He served as the first director of the White House Office of Faith-Based and Community Initiatives under President Bush from early 2001 until August of that year. His book is Godly Republic, A Centrist Blueprint for America's Faith-Based Future. It's published by the University of California Press. Professor DiIulio, thanks very much.
Thank you very much.